From the NBC newsroom in New York, here is John Cameron Swayze. With a new broadcast each Sunday at this time, Mr. Swayze is marking his 20th year as a top-flight news broadcaster. Once a Kansas City reporter, Mr. Swayze has had a distinguished career. He has won the Alfred I. DuPont Award for Excellence in News Reporting, Radio's First Michael Award, and has been named Commentator of the Year. In addition, Mr. Swayze is once again a newspaper man, writing a five-day New York column distributed nationally by McNaught Syndicate. But let's have the news, the last-minute news, and some of the week's feature stories we sometimes overlook. With them, here is Mr. Swayze.
Ladies and gentlemen, a good afternoon to you. General MacArthur has decided that Thursday of this week will be the most convenient date for his proposed address to Congress. This was announced earlier today by Republican House Leader Martin of Massachusetts. All the arrangements are not yet set. In fact, there has been no formal invitation for the general to address the joint session, but the majority of representatives and senators have no doubt that the Congress will approve the invitation. In less than 2 hours now, the MacArthur plane, the Bataan, will rise from Tokyo's airport to carry the general, his family, and aides back to this country. His first visit in 14 years. At this moment, thousands of persons are lining some 12 miles of streets in Tokyo, waiting to see the former Far Eastern commander drive from his home to the airport. The hero of the Pacific received the farewell wishes of all the Japanese, with the exception of the communists. Emperor Hirohito played a call on the general yesterday. Now, here is the MacArthur itinerary. First stop, Honolulu, where he will spend tonight and tomorrow. Tuesday, he leaves for San Francisco, and the Golden Gate City is planning a big reception. That reception, by the way, may be postponed until Wednesday if the general arrives too late on Tuesday night. And then, according to the latest information, New York will get its chance for the traditional ticker tape parade on Friday. Back in Tokyo, the man who is taking over the Far Eastern Command, General Ridgway, is waiting for his former boss to move out of the embassy house so he can move in. General Ridgway says he plans no change in basic policies laid down by MacArthur. On the fighting front, we have a report that Allied troops made an unsuccessful amphibious attempt to seize a Hwachon Reservoir Dam in central Korea. Elsewhere on the front, enemy resistance is reported decreasing, and UN forces are making limited advances in the face of an enemy scorched earth policy. Well, while the Chinese communists raise a smoke haze on the battlefront, the leader of the Chinese nationalists makes an attempt to clear another type of haze. Chiang Kai-shek, in an interview at his island capital on Formosa, charges that Great Britain, for what he called economic reasons, does not want to see China unified. In terms of reticence, President Truman, in his speech last night, went further. He refused to even mention MacArthur's name directly. The Republicans have lost no time in swinging back at President Truman after last night's Jefferson-Jackson Day speech. In his speech, Mr. Truman hit out at GOP critics of his foreign policy views, charged the Republicans with being more interested in winning the next election than trying to prevent another world war. The president is going to open another type of battle tomorrow, the battle for the American League pennant. Mr. Truman will toss out the first ball in the afternoon just before the world champion New York Yankees and the Washington Senators take the field at Griffith Stadium to start the 1951 season. Now, in the National League, the opener will take place in Cincinnati with the Pittsburgh Pirates tangling with the Cincinnati Reds. Well, speaking of baseball, here's another highly controversial subject. Who is going to win the Major League pennant this year? It came into the news with the first big selection of the winners. It was the annual United Press poll of sports writers, and just in case you weren't able to give the sports pages the customary amount of attention because of the great bulk of other news, the sports writers picked the New York Giants to win in the National League and the Boston Red Sox to cop the nod in the American. But just to show that nothing about baseball can long be free from argument, the sports editor of the UP, the news service that conducted the poll, he's Leo H. Peterson, and he thinks the Dodgers, instead of the Giants, will take it in the National. Friday the 13th came and went, and with it, a really extraordinary story from Milwaukee, extraordinary even for Friday the 13th. It concerns a man named Walter Otteson, who bought a new car on Friday from a dealer named Jack Friday. Now, Otteson was born on the 13th, in Section 13 of Polk County, Minnesota, which at that time was a community with a population of, in round figures, 13,000. He weighed 13 pounds, and if you add the letters in his name, they total 13. Otteson attended school for 13 years began teaching a country school in a township District 13 on September 13th, and there were 13 pupils in his class. After serving as mayor of South Center, Minnesota, the town of Sinclair Lewis Main Street, he traveled through 13 states and settled in Milwaukee, which is the 13th largest city in the nation. Otteson says he definitely is not superstitious, and then he suggests that we count the number of letters in that word. Well, no need to. There are, of course, 13. I was reading in the local gazettes about the word expert, Dr. Matford M. Matthews, and I was rather tickled to find him mentioning the word ink. I must confess to a mild affection for it, though I never have the audacity to use it in public. To me, one of the best of the quotes that come down to us from those persons who casually toss off the catchy phrase was Will Rogers, "A lot of people who ain't saying ain't eating." And I note that Bernard M. Baruch, when he arrived home from South Carolina, told reporters, "Ain't broken, just sprained." He was talking about his ankle. Dr. Matthews says the word goes back to Shakespeare. So, if I may say it, ain't an American original at all. And Dr. Matthews says neither is Tell It to the Marines. To me, that laugh was a real startler. The Booker T. Washington Birthday Memorial is a Negro educational organization located near Roanoke, Virginia. It scattered 2,000 specially minted 50-cent pieces around New York City with notes attached which ask that the coins be returned. It has now come up with the figures which show that New Yorkers, according to this test, are 89% honest. Well, that's a rather fair tally, I think. That's the percentage of replies, of course. The test is going to be conducted in a good many other cities, including Kansas City, Chicago, Philadelphia, Boston, Baltimore, and Pittsburgh. Now, this 89% scored in New York was far ahead of the results of the nation's first honor system parking lot, which was started in Greensboro, North Carolina. It's going out of business because, say the managers, people aren't honest. The box where parkers were on their honor to deposit a fee was nearly always empty. This rather surprises me. As a casual observer of such tests, I don't recall having ever heard of one failing before this. And I can remember that as I grew up, it was common practice for a newspaper to hang a stack of the early editions on a convenient lamppost at principal streetcar stops. A small pocket on the stack was for the buyers to drop their coin or make change if need be. Speaking of making change, a bank out in a St. Louis suburb not long ago put a jar filled with $25 in change on a counter in the bank and invited customers to make their own instead of asking the tellers. At last reports, it was doing all right. Here was a test of honesty and a good promotion stunt to boot. You know, banking generally, I believe, is shortening up as far as the business of publicizing is concerned. Here in Manhattan, it's not at all unusual for art exhibitions to be held with press previews in advance. Portraits are hung on the walls as in an art gallery, and they stare at the tellers across the lobby. Historical events or costumes are another trick. And some offer a variety of giveaways, such as timetables for the yachtsmen and baseball schedules for the fans. But from where I'm sitting, a certain small-town banking institution is the number one promotion exhibit. The bank I'm thinking about is in Pikeville, Kentucky. Reportedly, it was the first Money Mart to install an organ. The day was started with recitals and hymn singing. A radio brought in news and muted music. A garden was maintained, growing every flower known to the region. The bank and its offices were always adorned with them, and rooms were also supplied the local hospital, and at times the homes of ailing citizens. The final touch was a big refrigerator filled with soft drinks and cold cuts. Both customers and employees could help themselves to a snack. It was the idea of a man named John M. Yost. He's a far cry from the steely-eyed, flint-hearted master of money so widely publicized in story and cartoon. Well, speaking of money as we have been, here in New York, a 17-year-old youth, Freddy Skozetska, received a refund from the government on his income tax payment. What makes it news is that the check called for $300,000. In rapid succession, here's what happened. He went to the bank and the bank was closed. He showed it to a policeman who said, call the treasury. He showed it to his mother and his aunt and they couldn't believe it. He showed it to a former employer who dropped it like a hot potato and said, take it back quick. This leads me to think he may have had some experience with the treasury department before. Well, the boy took it to the principal of his school, who excused him from school for the day to return it. The treasury said, a most unusual case. By evening, Freddy Spozetka had received and disposed of $300,000. All he had out of it was a day off from school. Even in these times of inflated money, that's surprisingly little to get for 300 grand. The town of Hamden, Connecticut has sent out an SOS. The Hamden girls softball team needs a coach. Here is a wonderful chance for some man to boss nine women. But it's going begging. Personally, I feel that shows that either the need has not been properly publicized, or the men are finally getting smart enough to realize they simply can't boss the women. This brings to mind a recent story from the town of Oak Hill, Kansas. Seems that the men of Oak Hill were completely fed up with hearing the ladies complain about how they, the men, ran the municipal government. So when election time arrived the other day, the men put up a slate composed entirely of women candidates. They thought to elect the ladies and see how they made out. But the women were too smart. They promptly put up a slate of male candidates. The men worked for the election of the women, and the women worked for the election of the men. The women won. That is, they lost the election by voting the male candidate into office, which means they won their goal. They can still tell the masculine officials what's wrong with the way they run things. The Democrats' Jefferson-Jackson Day dinner was held last night, and in Washington, the crowd was so large that it had to be held in the National Guard Armory, a tremendous place I visited just a week ago. There are 4 acres of floor space. The statistics of such a dinner always fascinate me. Such items as the fact it took 1,100 salt shakers, 5,600 dinner plates, 550 waiters, 60 chefs, and others, all of whom were sent to the armory according to schedule in chartered buses. The biggest trick of all was to have the steaks just right. They were started in hotel kitchens, then put in special charcoal heaters and rushed to the armory by truck. They were done by the time they reached there. And the final touch, a special traffic system of red and green lights operated from a master control put the waiters in motion, delivering those steaks to the more than 500 tables. It may sound just a bit inelegant, but the most descriptive term I can think of at the moment is some feed. Senator Toby was in the news very pleasantly just the other day. I'm sure we all recall how the senator used to give vent to a considerable amount of righteous ire during the Senate Crime Investigation Committee hearing. Well, he was in Chicago this week past, and as he talked to reporters, he pulled a letter from his pocket. It was from Michael Kelly, who is 9 years old and comes from Salem Depot in Toby's home state of New Hampshire. Wrote Michael in part, "I think the Senate crime investigation should be continued. There are too many bad men in the world. I like the way you blow your stack." And that's the story, folks. Glad we could get together. Next Sunday, same time, same place, different stories. Let's get together again. Until then, this is John Cameron Swayze saying good afternoon.